I haven't been given the go-ahead by Gene Simmons, but it's late, and so unless there's someone knows a reason for not doing so, it seems appropriate to start. The procedure that I thought we would follow would be to go down the table in the order in which the members of the panel are sitting. But in doing that, I should like to suggest one or two topics as starting topics for panel discussion, which needn't be constraints on the members of the panel. The point that's been reached after the presentation of perhaps 90% of the data that were acquired in the Apollo 11 is one of a mood for interpretation, I think, and for some synthesis. And with that thought in mind, I suggest to the panel members that they consider at first the question of differentiation and granted the evidence for some differentiation of these once melted rocks following Paul Gass' thoughts of yesterday, that this differentiation need not have occurred inside the moon, although in the case of the differentiated Earth, it did occur inside the planet, but might have occurred on the surface or even before the moon was formed in space. However, assuming that it was internal, the differentiation, how can we reconcile that fact? Because it is a very common, an unspoken but common premise in this meeting. Reconcile the assumption of internal differentiation, very much like that of the Earth's history, with the fact that the mean density of the moon is the same as the density of the surface rocks at Tranquility Base, both very close to 3.3 or 3.4. Also that the moment of inertia of the moon is very close to that of a homogeneous sphere, within a few parts in a thousand, both implying a homogeneous body. And then second, with the existence of the maskons, the gravity anomalies, the departures from hydrostatic equilibrium locally, and finally, with the excess flattening ratio, the fact the moon bulges out at the equator more than it should for a body that's warm and plastic inside, as would be implied as a thermal history for a differentiated body. Dr. Ringwood has constructed a model which satisfies these important constraints on density and moment of inertia. That is why he's seated at my left. I hoped he might take up this point and then carry on with some remarks on the origin of the moon, which have formed a lot of the discussion of today's sessions as well.
As you know, the density of the moon is 3.34, and the coefficient of the moment of inertia is 0.402 plus or minus 0.002, which means that the moon is nearly homogeneous with respect to density. Now, two factors affecting density within the moon are the pressure distribution causing compression and the temperature distribution causing thermal expansion. We've got a pretty good idea how these work in homogeneous material, and they almost exactly cancel each other out. There is a third effect affecting the density, and that is the possibility of pressure-causing phase transformations. Now, what we can say very definitely about the moon is that there cannot be any major phase transformations leading to states of much greater density within the moon. Otherwise, you would contradict the moon's moment of inertia. Now, this, in fact, is a very strong constraint on the lunar internal composition, because within the moon we have a pressure regime going down of 47 kilobars at the center. Most terrestrial systems, when subjected to pressures of 47 kilobars, undergo major phase transformations to much denser states. What this says is that the composition of the moon must be such that it does not undergo any major phase transformations. Now, this immediately wipes out any composition similar to basalts, rocks which occur commonly at the Earth's surface and which we found at Tranquility Base. Because basalts undergo such phase transformations, they will contradict the moment of inertia. In fact, without going into any detail, I could say that the moment of inertia can only be satisfied if the moon contains less than about 6% of aluminium oxide. because aluminium oxide participates in phase transformations involving garnet at quite modest pressures, which will affect the moment of inertia. I could use some less direct geochemical arguments based on the constant ratio of calcium oxide and aluminium oxide in all sorts of meteorites and in the sun to suggest that the moon, in fact, cannot contain any more than 6% of calcium oxide. By such a process, I believe we can limit the internal composition of the moon to iron magnesium silicates, dominantly iron magnesium silicates with less than these amounts of aluminium and silicon. And this is, in fact, a composition from which we can show experimentally that we can derive the chemistry of lunar basalts by partial melting experiments. So that it is possible, I believe, to construct quite a straightforward, simple, self-consistent model of the lunar composition and the origin of lunar basalts by considering that they're formed by partial melting, a very small degree of partial melting, in the moon at depths of about 200 to 400 kilometres from iron magnesium silicates dominantly of pyroxene composition, as I suggested earlier. As I say, you can explain most things. There is one problem which is being talked about widely, and that is the europium anomaly. Now, I think it may be possible to explain the europium anomaly on this simple model, but on the other hand, we do not know the relevant partition coefficients. It may be that we need a more complex model. If we do, this will imply not only the partial melting in the lunar interior which formed basalts 3.8 billion years ago, but you'll need an earlier phase of partial melting or more complete melting, perhaps surface melting, in the moon, which occurred perhaps near the beginning of formation of the moon, which in fact could have caused this europium anomaly. But this is a problem which is simply soluble now that we know that it exists, and we hope we should have an answer on these partition coefficients within a month, which will enable us to select the relevant the correct hypothesis.
Dr. Ringwood, if the density is the same in these two phases, why should the lava rise to the surface? Isn't that a problem? This is an injection that Paul Gast raised.
The density of the lava is probably at its liquid of something like 3 grams per cc. The density of the uplands, as long as it is greater than 3.3 grams per cc, the lava is going to rise. I don't see any problem in the lava forming but very deep within the moon and rising because it, in fact, is less dense than the surrounding rocks to under hydrostatic equilibrium and spreading out.
You drew some conclusions about the origin of the moon, which might be very briefly summarized before we go on.
Well, I think that we have definite... The lunar basalts give us very valuable information about the composition of the lunar interior. And this information generally seen is this, that its composition is different from the lunar mantle, both in major elements and minor elements. The lunar mantle has been very strongly fractionated with respect to a number of very volatile metals. It has a different oxidation state. It has a different iron-magnesia ratio. Now, these considerations have quite an important bearing on the current hypotheses of origin of the moon. I believe they're inconsistent with most of the standard types of hypotheses in which in fission, simple fission, or in the binary planet hypothesis, you would expect basalts formed by partial melting to be in the moon to be the same as those on the Earth, and you'd expect similar lunar mantles to terrestrial mantles. I think, as I mentioned earlier, the capture hypotheses were originally developed to cater for the tidal friction story, which had the moon very close to Roche's limit only 2 billion years ago and very hot. The dating of the lunar surface, in fact, shows that this cannot be correct. The abundance of iron in the sun is also a major difficulty now for the capture hypothesis, since the iron abundance seems to be the same right through the terrestrial planets. So I feel we have to look elsewhere, and the direction in which I would look is in a direction which Dr. Erpik suggested many years ago, that the moon had in fact accreted from a series of planetesimals or debris which once orbited the Earth. Something analogous to Saturn's rings, only much more massive. I believe that such this uh, a, the material in this ring, in fact, may have been precipitated from a massive primitive terrestrial atmosphere when it cooled and was driven away. In such an environment, one can, in fact, explain the volatilization differences of elements which seem to differentiate the Earth from the Moon, and the various differences between the Earth and the Moon are explicable in terms of fractionation within an environment of a primitive atmosphere, dropping silicates in a ring around the Earth.
So how would you describe the theory, a variation of the Darwin-Wise theory of the origin of the Moon, or a variation of the binary planet?
Well, let's call it the Darwin-Ringwood-Wise theory, because in fact, in 1960, I modified Darwin's hypothesis to suggest that the Moon may have split off from the Earth's solid mantle when the core formed. And this was later developed by Dr. Wise and other people. But I don't believe that this model is acceptable any longer, because of the compositional differences between lunar rocks, lunar mantle, and terrestrial rocks. But it is definitely still related to this. The relationship is that the material now in the Moon, first of all, the Moon is genetically related to the Earth. The material in the Moon has come not from the Earth's solid mantle, but from the massive primitive atmosphere. So one could say it's a close relative, yes.
Do the other members of the panel have comments on these ideas? Dr. Runcorn. You should grab a microphone before you talk. Dr. Runcorn.
The problems that Dr. Ringwood has raised, of course, relate the measurements that have been made and described in the meetings with the broader questions of the origin and evolution of the Moon. And I'd first like to begin by commenting that we still haven't got quite a good basis for discussing the internal density variation in the Moon. We know, of course, we have known for 200 or 300 years that the fractional difference in moments of inertia of the Moon has a value, 0.006, which is about 17 times greater than the Moon would have if it were in hydrostatic equilibrium. And the recent measurements of the precession of the satellite orbits give one a value of the difference in the moments of inertia, C minus A and C minus B. And this, of course, was the data that Dr. Ringwood was referring to, which enables one to, by dividing the C minus A over A by the C minus A over MA squared, you can get the moment of inertia factor for the first time with considerable accuracy. And Dr. Ringwood points out, of course, that that is hovering now around 4.
0.4.
It hovered around about 1 some years ago, and was a great source of embarrassment. Now, we've just been listening to Dr. Wood talking about the uplands, and he suggested that possibly the uplands of the Moon are an orthosite of density about 2.8, and he's given reasons for thinking that this layer of an orthosite is perhaps about 30 kilometers thick. And certainly if one takes that into account, then of course one can put a small iron core in the Moon. And we've been listening also this afternoon to the first measurements of the paleomagnetism of lunar samples, particularly of course the crystalline rocks. And although of course on the Apollo 11 samples we haven't got orientations, the remnant magnetization of these crystalline rocks, and of actually two of the breccias, is of the order of 5 × 10⁻⁶ EMU per gram, and it appears, by the usual tests that are made in this subject, to be reasonably stable. And the tentative conclusion was put forward this afternoon that this magnetization was certainly magnetization acquired on the Moon, and probably at the time of the formation of the crystalline rock. This is, of course, a very tentative conclusion, but it is, I think, interesting to observe that the Apollo 12 magnetometer, which measured a field of about 30 gamma near the surface of the moon, and as Dr. Sonnet has pointed out, this magnetic field arose from quite a large portion of the underlying Maria, perhaps of the order of a few kilometers. It is rather interesting to see that a uniform, or a reasonably uniform magnetization of the bedrock underneath the Maria, of the order of that which is observed in the, which was reported in the session this afternoon, would explain this 30 gamma. So that I tend to think that the remnant magnetization was acquired during the cooling of this the crystalline rock 3.5 billion years ago. And the very interesting question arises, first of all, what sort of strength of magnetic field is necessary? Dr. Helsley has made some estimates of this and thinks in terms of about 1,000 gamma. And it seems to me that there are only two possible conclusions one can make concerning that field. Either the moon had a magnetic field in the past, 3.5 billion years ago, considerably greater than its present value, which can't be less. The global field of the moon can't be less than about 10 gamma at the present time, as we know from the Explorer observations. And so one, of course, begins to reflect on how the moon could have a magnetic field in the past and not have one today. We've been inclined, I think, in this subject to suppose that that small fluid iron cores are incapable of acting as dynamos. And certainly, all other things being equal, as you reduce the size of a convecting iron fluid core, you will get to a point when the natural decay of the magnetic field is more important than the generation process through the twisting up of lines of force by magnetohydrodynamic turbulence. And I think most people in this subject have been very satisfied that the Moon and Mars haven't got any very strong magnetic field because it's known, of course, that neither of them can have a very large core. But I think it is possible that the core in the Moon could be perhaps a third of the radius, and I think we do not know whether such a core, if liquid, could produce a magnetic field.
May I interrupt a moment? Is the core with a third of the radius compatible with the moment of inertia, Dr. Ringwood? I think not.
Yes, if you suppose that the surface layers are less dense than the basalt.
Would you like to comment?
This makes the problem even more severe.
But if the surface layers are eclogite, then maybe you could cancel some of it out.
I think
Mr. Weatherill, who just commented, was put on this panel to keep the rest of the panel members honest, because he knows the subject of phase transitions very well.
No, I'm just making use of the suggestion that Ringwood made, namely that at zero pressure, at low temperatures around 500 degrees, the stable form of the salt is eclogite. I'm not sure that's true, but he asserts that it is. And if so, one might be able to balance off a dense crust made of eclogite against some core and still get the moment of inertia come out to 0.4.
Yes.
It was big enough and strong enough.
Dr. Runcorn, because it's late, I thought we might go on to Don Wise. We can come back to this point.
It's always possible to choose among competing theories if you're willing to disregard half the evidence. And for a number of years, I've maintained that you didn't have to disregard too much more of the evidence to have a moon born from a primordial Earth than you have to disregard evidence for other hypotheses. And indeed, some of the contradictions or criticisms for a moon born from the Earth can be applied to other hypotheses as well. And as I watched the results of the various sample analyses being presented, I was gratified to see a number of things. One, the age dates of the moon seemed to be consistent with a birth from a very early solar system, which could have included birth from a primordial Earth. The similarities to terrestrial rocks are indeed striking. I'm impressed more with the similarities than the differences. This includes the evidence from the isotopic data this morning that the silicon and the oxygen isotopes are indistinguishable from terrestrial basalts and gabbros. Unfortunately, some meteorites also fall in this same category. Consequently, we can't use this as a proof either way. The hints of a less dense crust of the highlands, I think we're premature in assuming that it's a northocyte, nevertheless raise questions of what this means, how you generate it, and one of the consequences of a moon born by fission is proximity to a Earth heated to tidal incandescence, so that you have melting and possibility of crystal separation formation of that primordial crust. And basically, as a geologist, I'm impressed with looking at the orbiter photographs and still seeing that there is a smoothness to the general highlands topography on the rear side that we don't see for the highlands on the near side, suggesting there may be some fundamental asymmetry even in this oldest crust. So the conclusions that I come to from this are that we certainly have the possibility of a moon born from by fission from the Earth in its formative stages as a very active hypothesis. I don't think we have to disregard too much more of the data for this than we have to for any of the others. In fact, I think we have to disregard less.
Dr. Skinner, do you have any comments?
Yes, I have some comments, but I don't have an origin for the moon.
You may speak, nonetheless.
I start with the hypothesis that the moon exists. One of the questions that's been asked of me a number of times during the meeting, people assuming I'm a mineralogist, and I'm only a pseudo-mineralogist, that people have been impressed by the tremendous amount of work that seems to be done on exceedingly small samples, and what hell does it mean? It means that mineralogists have a fertile field to work in for years to come, but it also means, as far as the samples were brought back, that everything points to exceedingly rapid crystallization and very rapid quenching. This further means that the igneous bodies that these rocks came from must have themselves been rather small. The lava flows perhaps can only have thicknesses of the orders of feet, not hundreds of feet. This fits, as Dr. Jack Green pointed out during one of the questioning sessions, rather nicely with his interpretation, and I think other people's interpretation of many of the surface features in the Mare. But it's true that on Earth, in most major igneous provinces, even where the surface features are made up of stacks of rather thin lava flows, we see other igneous manifestations. We see sheets of intrusive rock at depth, and perhaps plutonic bodies, things that have not made it all the way to the surface and have had slower cooling histories. And some of these would, I think, be required or strongly suggested by the sort of models that Dr. Ringwood proposed, and certainly by the model that Dr. O'Hara proposed earlier today. The compositions of the primary rocks have a very bleak picture from one point of view. A question that was asked me a couple of days ago by somebody from one of the newspapers, and I don't know which one, he said, what's the chances for mineral deposits? After looking at these rocks, listening to the evidence, I think that there's a chance for iron deposits and titanium deposits, but we've got a lot of that on Earth, and if you're going to put your money into natural resources, don't be hoodwinked into investing on the moon. The chances are very slim. The geology points, to me at least, points quite the opposite direction from forming the sort of valuable mineral deposits, deposits of rare minerals, rare metals that we see here. The composition of the igneous rocks leads me to believe, if Dr. Ringwood's hypothesis is correct, that we must have some sort of core. Now, if the temperature distributions that are proposed for the moon are correct, I don't see that we are necessarily required to have an iron core, but I do believe we must have, albeit a very small one, an iron sulfide core. It may be very small, but I believe we must have some sort of segregation in the center. The soil is another fertile field for mineralogists to rake over, and there have been a great many papers. Not all of them have drawn the conclusion that I think is becoming more and more strongly pointed to, and that is that it's very difficult to propose an origin for the most of the soil material other than from the material below it, or from the material that yielded the rock fragments that were brought back. Within the soil, people are reporting fragments that look just like, compositionally, mineralogically, and textually, just like the primary rocks. And the materials that have been melted, that some of the glass beads, some of the partially glassy materials, have chemistries that strongly suggest local derivation, not derivation from great distances away on the moon. I realize this poses some difficult questions, to particularly to people who wish to derive the regolith from the highlands, but from the mineralogical evidence and the petrological evidence that's been presented, it's very hard to escape the conclusion that they came from local sources and not from distant sources.
Thank you.
Could I ask how you then reconcile the greater age of the dust than the crystalline rocks?
I think George Wetherill is the guy to answer that one.
I think first of all we have to make clear what we mean by the age of the dust. If we mean by the age of the dust the time at which these little fragments of material were crystallized, I don't think that that age has really been measured. I think some data bearing on that, for example, Wasserberg has measured a few fragments of the sort, which indicates that they're quite old, but no real age of the dust is available in the same sense that an age of the rock is available. Now, what the age of the dust might mean is simply that we are grinding up the lunar surface on some scale, perhaps on the scale of Mare Tranquillitatis, perhaps on a moonwide scale, and although fractionation is occurring, this grinding and mixing process continually puts things back together again, in which case we would be measuring something like the age of the moon, and there'd be no reason to expect that the dust would turn out by this approach to be younger than the rocks from which it is formed. In fact, it must be older if it is indeed the age of the moon. And so I don't think that at this point there's necessarily any problem associated with the numbers which have the dimensions of time, but have been loosely called ages, which have been associated with the dust work. With regard to the extreme local derivation of the dust, there is, I think, a rather apparent contradiction between making the dust out of actual tranquility-based rocks from the lead data, in that the uranium-lead ages on the dust are quite surprisingly concordant with one another, indicating that it looks like we're dealing with a closed system here as far as uranium and lead are concerned. There's all the rocks which Tatsumoto measured, and I also believe which will be reported on later by Silver, indicate that the rock ages are discordant, and you can't mix these together and make the concordant dust. So I think we must have more than a very local tranquility-based derivation, perhaps over a scale of some hundreds of kilometers at any rate, in order to balance or average in these other this other side of the story, which is there.
Dr. Ringwood, we know that there are dynamical objections to the theory of capture of the moon by the Earth. The second of the three main contenders suggests that the moon condensed as a minor accompaniment to the condensation of the Earth. Do you have a comment or a criticism of this view?
Well, the difficulty from this view, most statements of this, the so-called binary planet hypothesis, have the Earth and the Moon accreting from a mixture of silicate particles and metal particles, which were around in the solar nebula at that time, and with some physical process which caused the metal particles to selectively become concentrated in the Earth, and the Moon became rather enriched in the silicate particles. But nevertheless, the Earth's mantle, which is silicate, and the lunar mantle would still have been made out of the same sorts of rather well-mixed silicate material. And therefore, one would expect, even on this hypothesis, that partial melting within or any process leading to the formation of basalts in the Moon and the Earth, you would expect the basalts to have generally similar compositions. And the point that we've been making today is that there are very significant, although there are resemblances, there are very, very significant differences in chemical composition between lunar basalts and terrestrial basalts and between their respective source regions. And for this reason alone, and also for a dynamical reason put forward by Professor Urey some years ago, I think that the binary planet hypothesis for the Earth-Moon system looks very untenable today.
So that eliminates two of the three principal theories and leaves the Darwin-Wise-Ringwood theory. I thought I would invite you to make a closing comment and then ask for two comments from the floor, if there are any, before we end this very late session.
Well, first of all, this is just going to be the beginning. I think it's going to be a free-for-all with a whole host of new theories being advocated over the next few years. So I think we're in for some exciting times. But I think I agree. I think the traditional theories have got to be look very, very, very shaky right now. And we've got to look very seriously at new things, or at things which have been rejected in the past for inadequate reasons. Finally, I'd like to make one brief comment on the thermal history of the Moon, which hasn't been covered previously panel discussions. The potassium-uranium ratio of the Moon is about 3,000. Now, in the Earth, and particularly in meteorites, the principal heat-producing element is potassium. The low potassium-uranium ratio on the Moon poses a very severe thermal problem. If we are to get the Moon hot enough 4 or 3.8 billion years ago to produce extensive volcanism, and if this is, of course, assuming the case which we put before, that the volcanic material came from within the Moon. If we're to do this, what was the heat source? You cannot do it by any model. You cannot do it with a potassium-uranium ratio which is observed for the Moon and with any reasonable amount of uranium which you can put into the Moon. So what you're really forced to do is to assume that there was another heat source present very early in the lunar during the formation of the Moon. And the one that I'd would like to suggest is the gravitational energy of accretion of the Moon, which works out to about 400 calories per gram. This, to me, is about the only plausible heat source which can be used to get the temperature of the Moon up high enough early so that the initial increment from the rather small amount of potassium and the uranium can get the melting point above the solidus and form magmas a billion years later. Now, this, if one can argue this way, if you're forced, from geothermal reasons, to consider the gravitational energy as a principal heat source, this means the Moon starts off not necessarily molten, but certainly pretty warm. It will start off with a temperature which is low in the center and increases as you go out, because the gravitational energy goes up as the square of the radius. And finally, it implies a very, very short timescale for the accretion of the Earth because of the Moon.
And of the Earth.
Also of the Earth. But in the case of the Moon, Erpic has already argued that the Moon, and shown that if the Moon did form from a sediment ring of planetesimals, the time scale for accretion would be about 100 years. It's a very, very short business. And under such conditions, you could get gravitational energy trapped. On the other hand, other theories of the origin of the Moon will have the Moon accreting from material not orbiting the Earth, but material orbiting the Sun. The time scales are much larger. For a body as small as the Moon, there's no chance whatsoever of catching any gravitational energy. So I would suggest that this may be an argument. The thermal evidence may lead to be construed as an argument supporting Erpic's hypothesis that the Moon has to be accreted from Earth-bound planetesimals in a rather short time period.
I'm forced to agree with Harold Urey. If I had to judge the existence of the Moon on the plausibility of any of the theories, I claim it wasn't there. But I'd like to ask Professor Ringwood here. The accretion from a ring poses some very severe dynamical problems that Goldrich has shown that you have to form the moon at a very highly inclined orbit, and you just can't get a stable dust cloud at a highly inclined orbit to the Earth's equator. Therefore, you have some very severe problems with this.
Well, this is not my field, but I just would make the point that I don't think we have any reason to believe that the axis of the Earth's rotation is may be being constant in time, and I see no reason, now that we have a convection in the Earth's mantle and displacements of masses and continents on the Earth's surface, that the axis of the Earth's of the rotation may have changed substantially with time, and that accretion, in fact, may have occurred in the equatorial plane of the Earth. I agree it has to occur in that plane if it does.
This is a very interesting question. The hour is late, so I propose to close with two brief remarks from the floor, if there are any. John O'Keefe is the first. This is not planned.
With reference to that sediment ring, one of the things that impresses the people who work for NASA is the enormous amount of energy that it takes to put something into orbit around the Earth compared to the energy that you have. Aren't you going to be ultimately driven back on the rotational energy of the Earth in order to put enough energy into that sediment ring? Don't you ultimately have some kind of aren't you tied into the fission hypothesis in that way also?
I would refer to ask Dr. Rivick, but I agree. I think that the rotation of the Earth and the segregation of the core are all part of this process. The segregation of the core, that increases its angular velocity. It makes it easier to throw material off, but the material can be a gas, which I'm maintaining. So I certainly strongly suspect that this is part of the whole story. The other thing is that the segregation of the core heats the Earth. I think the Earth is already quite has to be warm before the core starts to segregate. But the segregation causes an additional heating by 1,500 degrees centigrade, makes it much easier to evaporate off material from the outer part of the Earth into the into an atmosphere which later precipitates.
But John's point is well taken.
That's the point. It isn't enough to just evaporate. You have to give it a tremendous shove to make wood into orbit. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, John, your point is well taken. I don't think you would.
I would
agree with it. It's a fascinating discussion, but it is late. Dr. Cameron, Al Cameron, a last question or comment. I should have called this originally the Wise Cameron theory. I'm very sorry to have neglected your name, Al.
I just about to. I'd like to remark that I arrived at Ringwood's basic point of view independently by a quite different route subsequently to that other business. Let me briefly indicate how some of the difficulties that have been mentioned can be overcome. First of all, anybody who has tried to look at the details of evolution of the solar nebula in recent times involving convection has arrived at the conclusion that the dissipation time is very short, 10 squared to 10 cubed years. When you accumulate a body the size of the Earth in that time, and assume it has its present dimensions, you arrive at a temperature throughout the interior and on the surface of some 10,000 degrees of that order. That implies, of course, that the surface is gaseous and will have the whole body will have dimensions quite large compared to the present one, extending out probably to several Earth radii as a very massive atmosphere composed of silicates and their decomposition products. Now, if you put the present angular momentum of the Earth-Moon system into such a body, you would find that rotational instability would be reached at about 3 Earth radii, which also happens to be about the Roche limit. Therefore, indeed, this atmosphere can be expected to condense beyond that point to be effectively an independent orbit, and the condensation effectively along the lines of as described by Uppig, which Ringwood has suggested, would follow. Secondly, if on the same time scale you accumulate the moon, you arrive at temperatures of the order of about 1,000 to 1,300 K, which brings it up to about the threshold for melting, and I've been very interested in this conference to see whether it got over that or not. I'm not sure which way to interpret the evidence yet that I've heard. I think it could be either way. But certainly we bring it up to about the right point, a very early initial heating, as outlined by Ringwood. And finally, since the Earth has volatiles, and since the situation I've just described is inconsistent with volatiles, you have to bring them in sort of as the last 10% of the accretion of cold bodies left in space after the dissipation of the nebula. And that accretion of the last 10% or so of the mass of the Earth will bring in with it a random angular momentum vector which can tilt the Earth's axis relative to the body which is formed in orbit, thereby, I think, overcoming the Goldreich objection.
In closing, I would like to take the chairman's prerogative to say that it was my impression that the laws of conservation of angular momentum and energy are violated in this connection unless Mars or a third body is formed at the same time, the suggestion that Littlewood made. But I won't give the members of the panel a chance to reply to this remark because it's later than 6:30. I thank them and the contributors from the audience very much.